Yesterday, we talked about some of the challenges associated with diagnosing adults with mental health concerns.
Right.
Today, we're going to discuss an even more challenging task, and that is diagnosing children.
I like your shirt.
Oh, thank you. Diagnosing children with mental health concerns, or adults with ADHD, distractibility.
That's very nice.
I've been sitting beside you for like
10 minutes. And I just noticed that. Well, I've been focused on today's article.
Yeah.
Written by Alan Francis.
Right.
Alan Francis, I think, he was in charge of, he played some role in DSM 4 and 5 about, and he knows a great deal about the process of psychiatric diagnosis. I think he was in charge of the whole project, maybe with DSM 4 or 5, I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
And he's written a whole book on psychiatric diagnosis. So mm-hmm. So he's really, really well informed. And that's one of the reasons why we chose this article. It was written by somebody who really knows the ins and outs of diagnosis.
Right.
But you're right. We talked yesterday about how easy it is to misdiagnose adults.
Mm-hmm.
Because you get inaccurate information or incomplete information.
Right.
Or people don't report everything because they don't think it's important.
Right.
It's even more problematic in children because mm-hmm. now you have a child and a parent.
Right.
So now you're getting two reports.
Right.
You have the whole school issue
mm-hmm.
and you have a developing brain that changes over time. So what you see at age 8 may not persist to age 15.
Right.
Okay? It doesn't persist physically
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't persist mentally.
Yeah.
So that by the time a child is 14 or 15, she could be completely different,
mm-hmm.
temperament, personality. And so we have that developmental aspect with children that we don't have with adults.
Right.
I mean, what you are at 25, you are the same things essentially at 35.
Yeah.
So you don't have as much developmental variation.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the developmental variation from one child to another, a five-year-old. Some five-year-olds can read and some five-year-olds don't know
right.
the alphabet.
Yeah.
It's all normal variation.
Right.
Okay? So it's a much more complex business in children. Okay. Hence the title,
mm-hmm.
Diagnoses in Kids Should Always Be Written in Pencil.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's from Psychology Today.
Right.
Now, we posted two articles
right.
from Psychology Today, but they both discuss the same type of issues. And that is, again, the challenges associated with making some of these diagnoses. And so today we're going to focus on a few. In this article,
yeah.
Alan Francis talks about, he has a list of 10 things that he says are major factors that must be considered.
Right.
And we'll kind of mention them, but there's a few that we're going to highlight more specifically.
Right, and he begins with a wonderful quote, and I want to read that, but he talks about three diagnoses in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And in the first beginning of the article, he says, the three most harmful fads in psychiatric diagnoses during the past 20 years have all occurred in kids. And then he notes that there's been a 40-fold increase
right.
in the diagnoses of ADHD, autism spectrum disorder, and bipolar disorder
right.
in children. And he talks about those three in particular. And you and I have talked about this many times.
Right.
Why? Remember when that study came out that what was it? The rates of ASD, and we thought that can't be,
right.
you know, 60.
One in 60 or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, 1 in 60, and we said
1 in 66, 1 in 55.
Yeah. Yeah. How could it be that yeah. high? Okay, and you look for different explanations, but we can't find any. You
right.
know, and you and I know because we developed an instrument to assess it. Bipolar disorder in children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what a problematic diagnosis right. that was in the early
yeah,
2000s.
Absolutely.
You know? And we could feel the rates increasing, and you and I kept wondering, do they really have this disorder?
Right.
Okay. And so this is a fascinating, a really good look at those three diagnoses in particular. Not
right.
the only three, but the three that have increased most dramatically.
Right. So again, he talks about 10 specifically, but there's a few that we want to really emphasize.
Mm-hmm.
And the first is, and I think maybe it's best to organize it by source of information.
You mean where these 10 came from?
The information that we get when we're diagnosing a kid, evaluating a kid, we're going to get information from a couple of different sources.
Right.
One is from the child directly, what he or she says. One is from the parent, what he or she says.
Right.
We'll say parent and other adults, teachers, things like that.
Yeah. And then all the adult caregivers.
Right.
Parents, teachers, grandparents.
Absolutely. And then and then another perspective from what we see. Directly.
Our observations.
Right. All right. And those three sources, each of them introduce error rates.
That's right. Each one carries with it some error.
Right.
And we know that. Okay. Mm-hmm. But no matter what we do, there's a little bit of error. You know, the Heisenberg principle,
right.
You know, where just by observing, you change things.
Right.
So there's always a little bit of error in whatever we observe.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So maybe it's best, how about if we do that? We organize it by the source of data?
Right. Okay.
All right.
I threw
you for a
little bit. It's a conditional yes. Because one of the things that Francis says is that one of the things that changed everything was the inclusion of Asperger's disorder.
In
DSM-4.
Right.
Because now you have a mild form of autism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it's often very difficult to and that's what you're talking about is, am I looking at Asperger's disorder or am I looking at just a shy kid?
Mm-hmm.
Just a kid who,
right.
you know, doesn't have really well-developed social skills?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it Asperger's? That is to say, is it a psychiatric diagnosis?
Right.
You know, and that's what you're talking about when you get these three pieces of information.
Right.
Is this what it is?
Right. And I.
Okay. So
because Francis talks about some of the structural issues that we have to use, sort of the framework that we have to use to make diagnoses.
Right.
And there are inherent limitations and issues and problems with that.
Right.
You know, the fact that there are the number of diagnoses in the DSM-5 that there are introduces a whole new set of problems.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, that's sort of, for some reason, I'm just thinking all stats today. That's standard error.
You're probably teaching this tonight, right?
This morning. Yeah, later this morning, I got to go teach some of this stuff. But that's standard error. That's the error that's inherent in the system that we can predict and that we know.
Yeah.
We know that more people are going to be diagnosed with some of these things because the system has been created in such a way that more people are going to meet diagnostic criteria.
Yeah.
So to me, the real crux of the problem is that when we are getting some of this information, some of the information that we're getting is good.
That's right.
And some of the information that we're getting is
faulty.
Not as good.
It's faulty.
It's
and again, there's no intent here.
Right.
But it's just that people use words and we interpret the words and sometimes we interpret them the way they were intended and sometimes we don't.
Right.
The problem is with a psychiatric diagnosis, the implications are lifelong and significant.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So let's think about some of the factors that, you know what, we'll leave off the clinician, the observation part,
right.
Because we'll talk about that tomorrow. We're going to talk about clinician-based factors that contribute to misdiagnoses. We'll put that tomorrow because that's going to come with experience and interpretation and some of those kinds of things. So let's focus on the child and the caregivers.
Okay, on their information.
That's the main information that we're getting.
Okay.
All right. So when we think about, we can start with either one. We'll start with the kid. Okay. So when we see the kid, many times, not always, but many times, kids are brought to see a counselor or therapist or mental health professional, not necessarily kicking and screaming, but they don't. It's not necessarily where they want to be.
They don't want to be here.
Right.
Their parents might want them to be here,
right.
But especially the teenager, but many children too.
Right.
They don't volunteer for this.
Right.
The parents say, you know, we have to get another opinion here.
Right.
We are going at 3:00. I'll be coming to school to pick you up at 1:00, and we have a 2:00 appointment.
Yeah.
Right. The child has no vote.
Right. Mm-hmm. So when the child comes, especially those first few visits, our goal is really just to build rapport well enough to where the kid will talk to us.
That's right. Building a therapeutic relationship right. with the child isn't a science.
Right.
It's an art.
Right.
And you gain experience over time, but right. you don't automatically start. With an adult, an adult volunteers to come in.
Right.
And they're typically...
Usually.
You're right. They're typically very... Unless it's court-ordered or right. there's a divorce or, you know, they're there under duress for some reason. But typically, adults come in on their own mm-hmm. and are willing to disclose
right.
More, not all, but they're willing to disclose more information because you have a partner. Children are resistant. They're there not of their own right. free will, and they're more resistant. So it takes longer to build a therapeutic relationship right. with a child.
Right. So that's our first obstacle, is that the kid doesn't necessarily want to be there. And so they're not going to be as forthcoming, as right. open, as descriptive as we would want or need them to be to really be confident about a diagnosis.
That's right. They're not going to tell us everything. Mm-hmm. You know what every teenager holds on to is their drug. You know,
right.
they don't admit to it. They don't know whether they can trust us or not. Right. We tell them that we're not going to tell their parents. They don't believe that
right.
at the first visit. So they withhold those mm-hmm. kinds of, you know, sex, have you, you know, their boyfriends and girlfriends,
mm-hmm.
you know, they don't want to disclose too much about that. Right. They don't want to disclose their late night phone use.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to disclose drug and alcohol
right.
Use. And so there's a lot of information that we don't get
right.
initially.
Yeah.
And it takes time for that to come out.
Exactly. So, mm-hmm. so that's sort of the first obstacle. The second obstacle has to do with, and I've mentioned this, you know, we've mentioned this many times before. Mm-hmm. It is a matter of vocabulary.
Right.
You know,
right.
children and teenagers experience all the same emotions and experiences and feelings and all of that that everybody else does, that adults do.
Right.
The problem is that they don't necessarily have the vocabulary and the experience to articulate and to differentiate some of these different feelings.
I'm laughing because when kids come in and we ask them how they felt about something,
mm-hmm.
typically, and I can't use the word, I don't want to use the words here that they use,
mm-hmm.
but they use words for anger, you know, mm-hmm. certain words for anger. And then they'll come in and say, well, I was really upset. I was really angry. I was really this, right? It's not that they were angry, it's that they were hurt.
Right.
You know, they,
mm-hmm.
whatever happened hurt their feelings. But they don't think of it as I was hurt. They think of it right. as I was angry.
Right.
Okay. So they just, you're right. They don't have the vocabulary to label all of their emotions mm-hmm. accurately until they're, sometimes even teenagers don't
right.
have that vocabulary.
Exactly.
You know? So,
exactly.
And sometimes adults don't.
Right.
You know, they'll just come in and talk about their anger. Well,
right.
it's really that they were hurt.
Right. right? And we work to differentiate by, you know, you can figure out creative ways to ask things like, were you mad, or were you sad mad, you know,
right.
or were you, you know, worried yeah. mad, or were you, you know, because mad, angry, is a generalized emotion that is used
right.
to represent stress and anxiety and depression and sleepiness and
right.
hungry, and it, you know, it is sort of a universal emotion there. And so we have to weed through that to figure out
right.
what we're really talking
what
about. And so vocabulary is a very big obstacle that we have to get over
right.
to make our diagnosis
mm-hmm.
with kids.
Right. Yeah, it is. Oh, it's an enormous obstacle because they don't have the words.
Right.
They don't have the accurate descriptions of what they're feeling.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and then sort of the third big issue that comes from the child, him or herself, has to do with the way in which they attribute other things. And this is when they are attributing what's happening with their parents. They will, you know, well, she's just doing this and she's just doing that. And the way that, we've talked about attribution theory and things like that before, but for kids especially, they so firmly believe that it's true
mm-hmm.
that they present it as though it is absolute fact.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
my mom doesn't want me to have any fun. Now, it sounds very, oh, you know, woe is me, But when a kid says that, they like truly believe that.
Yeah. Oh yeah. My parents hate me.
Right. Right.
You know, they'll say that.
They truly believe it.
They truly. Now they don't mean hate. We don't know what they mean by hate.
Right.
Okay. But they truly believe that their parents are out to get them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. And so it makes it very difficult because everything that they then talk about related to that is tinted with that perception.
Right.
And so they talk about things in a negative way. Sometimes that's more exaggerated than it otherwise would or should be,
right,
because of this attribution that they hold so firmly.
Right, right. Yeah, but that's the way that they think.
Right.
And they don't use language precisely. We can't expect them to use language precisely.
Right,
right.
Yeah, so it does go back to that language, that vocabulary issue.
Right.
But, yeah. Did you have another one for kids? What do you...
No, I want to...
All right.
I'm excited about these 10 things that Alan Francis said.
I know you are.
I'm chomping at the bit.
I know you are.
You would do that?
Yeah, I can tell. I'm attributing this anxiety to you.
Some days are easier than others here in the office.
Yeah, some days. So do you want to get to the 10 now?
I don't know.
Go ahead, sir.
I like what you're doing here.
Go number one.
No, I'm not ready to do number one.
You're not?
No, you know what I want to say.
What?
One of the recurring themes here is that when we use psychiatric diagnoses to make educational decisions.
Okay.
Right? That's a recurring problem here. But this work, these 10 that we're alluding to, come from a wonderful project, I believe, in Argentina? There are two professionals there.
Argentina.
Yeah, Vassen and I don't know how it's Untoilich, I think. Untoilich. I don't know how to pronounce that person's last name, but they have...
I wasn't even going to try.
They're so concerned about misdiagnosis in children, they've started an organization called Forum Infancias, mm-hmm. Children's Forum, mm-hmm. to discuss this issue, to study this issue of misdiagnosing children. So I didn't know this organization even existed, mm-hmm. but it's a problem there as well. I think it's a problem worldwide,
right.
Not just a problem in the United States. So I'm going to have to look that up and see the work that they're doing.
Right.
But the 10 things that Alan Francis talks about, many of them come from that Argentinian group.
Right.
Who have studied this issue in detail.
Right.
Anyway, that's where they come from, which I need to look that up. And I'm embarrassed to say I didn't know about that. So.
Right. So, and some of these are those factors that come from the caregivers the child. Like, for example, number one, the first one has to do with the responsibilities and the expectations that we have on kids.
Yeah.
That the expectations both of what they need to be doing and what we expect from them behaviorally have significantly changed.
How many times have you said it's inappropriate to have a kindergarten student do a book report?
Thousand?
Yeah, you've said it many times this week.
Mm-hmm.
But it's something we talk about. You talk about it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true. You know, that's what he's talking about in this first one, is that we have redefined education in our country. In the past 20 years, we've redefined the entire educational experience.
Mm-hmm.
That has nothing to do with the child.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But he uses the phrase, just because a child doesn't fit into those roles that are, he says, recent, constraining, and narrowly defined.
Mm-hmm.
You're expected to go to school now, and a kindergarten, a five-year-old is expected to be able to read.
Mm-hmm.
That's an unrealistic, that's a new expectation. We didn't do that even 10 years ago,
right.
15 years ago. So these are narrowly defined and very recent. And just because children can't do these things, we shouldn't put the onus on the child.
Mm-hmm.
It's an unrealistic expectation.
Right.
Okay.
All right.
Second?
The second one is one you mentioned already, and that is that you know, that there's a drastic difference, a drastic spectrum of normal development. Right. And we just have to remember that, you know, while some kindergartners can read and write, other kindergartners will struggle to know their alphabet, and that's still within the normal range of development.
Right. Children are expected to walk between 10 and 14 months. There's nothing wrong with walking at 13 months, and there's no advantage in walking at 10 months.
Right.
That's called normal variation.
Right.
Okay. And we often forget about that when we're dealing with kids and we're evaluating them on that highest standard.
Right. Now, number three, and we probably should pick up the pace because we're already after over 20 minutes into this podcast. Number
is
three.
It really? 20
yeah.
minutes?
Yeah.
That's because we were talking about your shirt.
You were talking about my shirt.
All right.
I mean, I don't blame you. Number three is that many times issues in systems, systematic
That's
issues,
right.
like issues in the education system, instead of looking at them as educational issues, we're blaming them on the kids.
Absolutely.
You know, we're saying, well, you know, if you were doing what you should be doing, you would be able to accomplish this, or you would be able to meet these expectations. Mm-hmm. And so it, again, the expectations is such that kids can't meet them,
right.
Or many kids can't meet them. And then instead of saying it's a problem with the system, we're blaming it on the kids.
Right. That's right. We attribute it to the child rather than any other factors.
Right.
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 And fourth is one of our favorites.
Yeah.
We expect kids to be perfect.
We do.
We expect kids. There's no adult in the world who expects you to go to work 180 days in a row and get it right all the time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's just not, I mean, nobody expects me to get it right every single day or to be in a perfect, productive frame of mind every day. We acknowledge that adults have good days and bad days, whether it's a professional athlete, mm-hmm. whether it's, no matter what it is. The only thing I want to have perfect is my surgeon.
Right.
We expect right. perfection That's there, true. Right? But children are expected to come to school every day
right.
to be attentive, to be alert, to be productive, to be well-behaved.
Right.
We don't expect that. I don't think we expect that anywhere else. In right. baseball, if you get it right one out of three times, you're a superstar.
Mm-hmm.
If you get it right one out of three times.
Right.
Okay. We don't expect that kind of consistent performance day after day after day after day, except in school.
Right.
I don't understand that.
Right. Now, number five is, you know, when a student is struggling, for whatever reason, we require basically a psychiatric diagnosis in order to give them help.
In order to give them special services.
Right.
Right. If you have a diagnosis,
right.
we can give you special services.
Right.
And that's something that we rarely talk about in our country, but that's something that we really need to put a stop to.
Right.
You don't use a psychiatric diagnosis to get educational services.
Right.
Okay. Again, we don't do that anywhere else.
Right.
We only do it in education.
And this goes on to number six as well, that just because you have some variations in behavior
right.
doesn't necessarily mean that A, you have a psychiatric disorder,
right.
That was number five, or six, that there's some chemical imbalance in your brain.
Exactly.
Necessitating medication or something else.
Yeah. Yeah, Alan Francis refers to that as biological reductionism.
Right.
You don't reduce everything to biology.
Right.
Everything is not a chemical imbalance or a structural anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
There are other factors like environment and social factors and temperament mm-hmm. and all these others that contribute. It doesn't all reduce to biology.
Right.
We need to be very cautious.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, earlier this week, we had a meeting where number seven kind of poked
yes,
his head out just a little bit.
Right.
And that is that, you know, when it comes to making a diagnosis, it takes a lot of time, especially when you're working with kids.
That's right.
And there are, the system is set up in such a way that we're expected, as the mental health professionals, we are expected to know a diagnosis and be able to give a complete and comprehensive treatment plan after seeing them for about 45 minutes.
That's right.
Now, we talked just a little bit ago about the fact that that first visit is not a visit that they necessarily want to be in.
Right. That's right.
But we're expected to have all the answers after that 30 minutes.
Earlier in the podcast, we said you're not getting all the information. Even with an adult, you're not going to get all the information in the first visit.
Right.
You and I have talked about that many times. Assuming that you can establish a trusting therapeutic relationship, it's still going to take several visits.
Right.
With children, it may take months to right. get to get the accurate diagnosis.
Right.
But insurance companies expect us to be there after the first visit.
Right. And it's because that what people don't tend to understand, number eight, is that while it's super easy to give a diagnosis, Right. It's really difficult to take one away.
Yeah, there's no eraser.
Right.
And especially now with computerized records, that diagnosis stays with you forever.
Right.
I had a parent one time who intentionally changed her child's birthday by one day so that in the future, the diagnosis couldn't be attributed to him in medical records because she intentionally did. She's an attorney, and she intentionally gave the wrong date of birth.
Interesting.
By a day. And so it looked like a typo, but it couldn't be attached to him. And if the diagnosis didn't hold across time, it wouldn't be his.
It's interesting. Now, number nine is that, you know, again, it's kind of related to what we were talking about earlier, that many times laws and rules and regulations are written with a specific diagnosis in mind.
Right.
And so, again, to access services or supports or anything related to that, you have to meet that diagnostic criteria.
That's right. Education law is federal law. I mean, the regulations were written around these diagnoses, and we often forget that these are federal regulations that we have to follow.
Right. And then the final is that, of course, we don't have a crystal ball. We don't. We can't. I said this yesterday. I think we don't know what we don't know. It's impossible for us to know what we need to, what specific things we need to ask. We work really hard to develop a clinical interview and a diagnostic approach, but everybody's different. And so it's really impossible for us to know, what with this person I need to do this way, or with this person I need to ask this question. We just don't know.
We don't know what it's going to look like 4 or 5 years from now. You and I stumbled into that when we first started seeing kids with emotional meltdowns, and what was called bipolar disorder in those years. And these children would come in at 12 or 13, destroying houses, attacking their parents, running away from home. And you just assume that, wow, this is really a serious mental illness. You know, what's going to happen in the future? And in almost every case, as those children progressed through adolescence, they finally pulled it all together in late adolescence, and these were no longer problems. And they went to college or they went into the military, and they're now living productive lives. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't have predicted that when they were 13.
Right.
So he's right. We don't have a crystal ball and with children, and so we don't know what it's going to look like 10 years from now.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So needless to say, for all these reasons, it's really difficult to diagnose children.
Right, it's easy to make mistakes.
Easy to make mistakes, and it's going to need consistent revising because things change. As we get more information, as we understand things a little bit differently, it's going to be, things are going to change.
Right.
So we've got to be cautious, all right? Tomorrow we're going to talk about clinician-based challenges and factors that contribute to misdiagnoses, and that's hopefully that one won't be as long. This one's almost 30 minutes. So we're sorry for the longer podcast.
But we have to take care of the children.
Right.
Right.
And Richard has to talk about my shirt. So I appreciate that.
Yesterday you had flies on your shirt.
I did.
Could you see them on the video?
I don't know.
Yeah, yesterday his shirt has flies all over it. I mean, not real flies. Fly prints. And not trout flies. Garbage flies.
Is that a new genus?
Garbage flies?
Garbage flies?
You know, there are flies you use for fishing. You know,
so I see.
It wasn't an Orbis shirt. You know, it was a garbage fly shirt that his wife bought. It's an interesting shirt.
As he said, some days here in the office are very interesting. So
some days it's easier than others. What day is it today, by the way? I've lost all track of time this week.
I think it's still yesterday. All right. Until next time.
Like we're coming back from the Philippines. What day is that? I have no idea.
I don't know. I don't know anymore. Until next time.
Stay.
Which could be just in a few minutes. Who knows? Stay happy, stay healthy, and forget to be afraid.